Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The pandemic, 19 months, but who's counting, has been just an incessant sprint to get ahead of COVID-19. From scaling up PPE to testing, tracking variants, administering the vaccine, now boosters, not to mention outreach. The state's response has been relentless and one largely without a handbook. But there are established tools in place when a crisis strikes. During the pandemic, one tool are emergency no-bid contracts to expedite building the infrastructure to protect and care for Californians in all things COVID. But because of that streamlining process, the traditional bidding, which often includes months of vetting companies vying for that state funding, simply doesn't happen. And that can raise ethical questions. Earlier this year, Cap Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd found that over $1 billion in no-bid COVID-19 contracts went to companies that contributed more than $700,000 to the governor and his political campaigns. Scott joins us today with his latest investigation into no-bid contracts, about one in particular that has ties to former President Trump's border wall, which Newsom very publicly detested and fought. Scott, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks, Vicky, for having me on.
Scott, you began investigating California's no-bid contracts at the beginning of this year. We have links to all of those stories on our Insight page, but just remind us, what sparked you to look into this?
Well, no-bid contracts always raise questions and concerns, especially for government ethics folks, where, you know, the bidding process, while it can take a long time, is important for government contracts. It's supposed to put the contract out to the public, let people know that this work is being done by the government. And the bidding process is essentially a vetting process to take a look at the companies that say, hey, we can do this work. This is for how much. And the purpose of that process is to make sure that the company is on the up and up, to make sure the company can do the work it says it can, and to make sure that the state is getting the best price possible for that kind of work. So, you know, anytime that no-bid contracts are awarded, it's always worth looking at to see, you know, who's getting these contracts, what was the process like? And, you know, here during COVID, there have been many no-bid contracts awarded. We are certainly in an unprecedented moment. You know, we're under, you know, still a pandemic, still an emergency. So these contracts, many of them had to get out the door quickly. But again, it's worth taking a look at to see, you know, what's in them and how they were awarded.
Right. And even though there's no illegal wrongdoing, there are other ripple effects potentially.
Exactly. You know, in the contracts that I've looked at, you know, both with this one as well as past ones, folks may know the BYD contract that the state awarded to a Chinese firm that provided masks and PPE, and that the value of that contract was about $1 billion. No illegal wrongdoing there. But again, it's important to take a look at to see what kind of work is being done for California and how much it's costing.
Today, about 8 months later, you have another investigation about no-bid contracts. What did you find?
So this January, the state entered into a contract with a company called SLSCO. That company specializes in disaster response and construction, and they built large sections of the border wall, Trump's border wall, in California. They did a pivot to healthcare in recent years during the pandemic, and they said that they could provide healthcare staffing to the state of California. The contract started at around $10 million, but it quickly ballooned, and the state has paid hundreds of millions of dollars to this company for healthcare staffing. And, you know, the massive increase in this contract's value was for a few reasons. Coming off of the COVID surge in the winter, you know, there was a need for greater staffing throughout California. There's a staffing shortage in the healthcare industry in general, and there was a greater push for vaccines. The company provided thousands of staff that were sent around the state, and some of those staffers went to community health organizations that actually provided services to undocumented Latino and farm worker communities. And the other reason why this contract increased so significantly is that the company provided work at the border. They actually screened and vaccinated about 60,000 migrants who had come across the border in the shadow of the very border wall that they built to keep migrants out.
Well, Governor Newsom, I mean, was just on national networks bashing this border wall. So this isn't really that far in the rearview mirror. Why would California then choose to partner with the company tasked with building that wall?
You know, in the course of my reporting, I found a lot of people who were asking that why question, and especially immigration advocates and community health leaders. And, you know, it's more than just words from Newsom. You know, the state sued Trump to halt border construction, and that actually includes projects that were being conducted by this company, SLSCO. And in short, you know, the state was desperate. The state, you know, like I said before, there was a serious need for healthcare labor. There's a shortage in the industry. The state actually entered into about a dozen contracts, you know, with other companies as well to get healthcare staffing. So this wasn't the only one by any means. But this was one that the state certainly relied on for thousands of staff to be sent around the state. Another reason why the state appeared to have tapped this company is because they could provide bilingual staff. And the State Department of Health argues that this was an asset for them, especially when processing migrants who are coming across the border.
What did you learn when it came to what SLSCO actually accomplished in California's COVID-19 response?
So just a quick breakdown of the numbers. You know, they provided about 6,000 staff, sent them around the state. And right now, about 300 to 350 remain. However, that number could increase as the state tackles booster shots and as school vaccine mandates start to roll out. The state assigned those staff, to public health departments, clinics, and mass vaccination sites. And the company, as I said before, was doing work at the border, screening, processing migrants. They had administered about 12,000 vaccinations, and they tested. They administered about 60,000 tests to migrants who had just come across the border.
Yeah, so just kind of circling that back around, the same company tasked by the Trump administration for building a border wall, now in the business of vaccinating and screening undocumented and migrant residents.
That's correct. And in fact, building multiple sections of border wall in California, as well as some other states. And, you know, one immigration advocate I spoke to said this felt like working two ends against the middle. You know, that said, the California Department of Public Health and the company SLSCO, they disagree with that type of characterization. But again, it caught advocates and community health people by surprise because Newsom repeatedly expressed support for the undocumented community, for farm workers, for the Latino community. In fact, here he is at a vaccination drive at a food packing plant in Riverside County back in February, shortly after this contract was signed, talking about farm workers.
We're here to celebrate them, truly essential workers here in this state and all across this country, but particularly here in our state. We're here to identify their remarkable contribution to our state and nation, but also to recognize our unique responsibility to do more and do better to support them. And you know, frankly, we haven't done enough, and we have to own that. We have to recognize that we haven't delivered on equity like we should, like we must.
And so again, that was Newsom in Riverside County back in February. Fast forward to this summer, the state sent staff from that border wall company, SLSCO, to Riverside County, where they actually staffed vaccination campaigns specifically aimed at reaching those migrant farm workers and undocumented people Newsom was just talking about. And you know, this news caught, you know, this news caught a number of immigration advocates and public health folks by surprise, as I said before, including the main immigration advocate that had been behind organizing these recent vaccination drives in Riverside County.
So what is the governor's office? What have they responded to this investigation and your findings?
So before publication, I sent a detailed 450-word email to the governor's office explaining what I found in the contract, explaining the work that was done, and also requesting comment and wanting to talk with him or a member of his cabinet about how this contract squared with California's values, the values laid out by the administration, his expressed support for undocumented communities. But he didn't respond. No one in the office did. I did reach out to the California Department of Public Health as well. They declined an interview, but they did answer questions over email. And, you know, they said, SLSCO met the qualifications to provide quality medical staffing. They said this staff was important in terms of contributing to the overall vaccination effort in California. You know, I asked if CDPH knew about SLSCO and their border wall history, and the department said they claimed that they weren't aware. They said that they only vetted the company for its qualifications to provide healthcare staffing. And this kind of comes back to potentially this no bid issue. You know, people I spoke to wondered how much vetting went into looking at this company and really considering their past during the negotiation process. Again, it's hard to tell because when it's a no bid contract, a lot of that just happens behind doors, so to speak, usually over email or over phone. And it's also worth noting, if you Google SLSCO, their border wall work appears on the first page of results. So this is not a secret.
What did the company say?
The company also declined an interview. They provided a short statement via email. They said that they were honored to work with California to help address its staffing shortage.
You know, getting back to the money, I mean, we were initially talking about millions of dollars and then now upwards of a billion. I mean, how much money ultimately are we talking about in the as an end result and in what time frame?
So it has fluctuated a bit. As I mentioned before, the contract was inked in January and it started at $10 million. Within 5 months, the amount of the contract had increased to up to $1 billion, a huge contract. But in recent days, the state actually slashed the amount of the contract by $650 million down to $350 million. After Cap Radio sent detailed questions about the state's partnership with this company, SLSCO, and also the asking questions about this company's border wall work and some of the controversy that it's caused, the state says that the reduction in the cost of the contract is just a reflection of the scope of the company's work so far. But again, that reduction came about 9 months after first signing it and just a few days after Cap Radio started asking questions.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Cap Radio state government reporter Scott Rond about his recent investigation into the state's no-bid contracts during the COVID-19 pandemic. You spoke to immigration advocates and community health groups for this story. What concerns did they raise about this partnership?
You know, community health organizations said that it's really important for them to build trust with the clients that they serve, because often it's underserved communities. It's folks who are coming from communities that may distrust the healthcare system. Often that includes undocumented folks, people who are in the farm worker community, migrant communities. And the folks I spoke to said, you know, that puts that trust, having workers from SLSCO, this border wall company, doing work on the ground for them, it puts it in jeopardy. You know, that trust could be jeopardized. And, you know, just here in Sacramento, the state sent about 10 staff from this company to the Sacramento Native American Health Center, which the health center said they had no idea that they had gotten workers from this company. And the center, you know, helped organize campaigns for underserved and undocumented communities. I spoke to CEO Britta Guerrero, and she said she was disheartened to hear that they had used some of these staff.
We represent Black and brown communities, underserved folks. That's who we are. We are from the communities that we serve, and keeping our communities and our patients safe is at the center of who we are. And so working with an organization that has done the opposite, it's hurtful.
And again, Guerrero said she had no idea that the state was sending these sorts of staff to work on the efforts that the Sacramento Native American Health Center was helping to put on. And immigration advocates, you know, they said rewarding a company that had profited off the border wall, which they see as a symbol of division, is a big concern. They, you know, just as a reminder, the state filed a lawsuit against Trump over its border wall construction, and that includes projects by this company, SLSCO. I spoke to Pedro Rios. He directs the U.S.-Mexico border program at the American Friends Service Committee, and here are some of his thoughts.
To me, what it shows is just a lack of historical memory to be able to hold accountable those companies that were profiting from that type of business, where the values were inconsistent with the values of California.
And, you know, he also responded to a claim by CDPH, the state public health department. which said SLS, the company behind the border wall and that provided the staff, said the workers they sent were bilingual, which helped advance equity and advance connections with hard to reach populations. Rios said that this rationale seemed like a joke, and that's a direct quote. He said plenty of other organizations could have provided this type of work, ones that didn't have a connection to the border wall.
Was there anyone you found who said, you know, this is just business as usual, or even just kind of tempered the concern shared by the groups that we just heard from?
And, you know, there were. It's important to note that. For example, I spoke to Madera County Public Health Director Sarah Boss. She said that the state provided, or rather SLSCO, they provided high quality staff. And this was important for the county's effort to get folks vaccinated.
SLS staff were an integral part of our vaccination efforts in Madera County. The agency deployed nurses quickly, and we found that the quality of the staff was very good. They provided excellent service to our community and our residents, on par with our expectations of our regular staff in Madera County.
And, you know, they weren't the only county that said that. Riverside County said something very similar. Sarah Boss, you know, from Madera, said, you know, she wasn't aware of the company's history building border wall in California, but she said her top priority at the end of the day as public health director is ensuring that there's quality care and vaccine access for her residents. And she also said she has to rely on the state for these sorts of staffing contracts because it's hard for small counties to negotiate these contracts themselves.
Before we let you go, Scott, is this story over or are there more developments to follow?
You know, this is definitely a story that I plan to continue to follow, continue to report on. I'm interested in getting more reaction from immigration advocates, more reaction from community health groups and county health departments that had worked with this company. Also interested in getting reaction from lawmakers. So this story, I definitely see further developments and more reporting.
That is Cap Radio State Government reporter Scott Rodd. Scott, thanks.
Thank you again for having me on.
And you could read the full investigation at capradio.org. It published this morning. Up next, an overdue uplifting update for one Sacramento family stranded in Afghanistan. Plus, a new NPR poll found a third of families are struggling to find child care. We'll narrow in on how on Sacramento to better understand the issue. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. It's been nearly 2 months since the U.S. withdrawal in Afghanistan, and Sacramento refugee families are still fighting to find their way back home safely. Dozens of families between San Juan Unified and Sacramento City Unified School Districts were living in limbo in Afghanistan. To say that the uncertainty was tense and terrifying is an understatement. But today we have some overdue and far from guaranteed relief for one family. They found their way outside of Afghanistan and, as I speak, are on their way back home. Nate McGill is the principal at Ethel I. Baker Elementary within Sac City Unified. Nate has been in constant contact with this family since the very beginning and joins us with this great update. Welcome back to Insight, Nate.
Hi, Vicki. Thanks for having me.
This has just been a long journey, and you've been helping from more than 7,000 miles away. How are you feeling this morning?
A lot of relief today. I don't even know what day. I think it's Tuesday. So Sunday, I was feeling a ton of relief, and that's continued. It's a great moment for us.
I mean, without compromising their safety, just remind us how your students and their parents ended up stuck in Afghanistan.
Yeah, so I can share to the extent that I can for the safety of, you know, their operation and also, you know, future endeavors to get American citizens and green card holders out. Basically, it was a really coordinated effort on the ground with some folks that are their entities, we'll call them, along with an NGO, a non-governmental organization who helped get these folks out.
What did you?
I know that's pretty unclear. Sorry about that.
No, and I understand. I mean, their safety is the most important thing. But for you, I mean, you're in the education field. You're a principal. What did you learn throughout this ordeal?
Yeah, well, I was the first of all, it was an honor to be a part of it. I think I got a little closer peek behind the curtain than the next person would, as I was involved with the process throughout, which was eye-opening. The thing that I think I learned the most was that there is a pretty amazing network of volunteers and folks who would be considered ex-military personnel working to get these things done, specifically in this case, get folks evacuated out. And you know, to me, it was a pretty amazing display of patriotism, if we're thinking about getting American citizens and green card holders out, you know, in a way that could be considered dangerous or at least risky.
You were constantly communicating with them over the course of nearly 8 weeks. Is there a moment from that communication that really hit home how grave of a situation they were in?
Yeah, the times that both mom and dad shared from the local social media or media about the murders that were basically in plain sight, and just like the violence and the threat of violence. Those were some of the more harrowing moments, you know, as the family described wanting to get out because they were worried for their lives, and with good reason.
There was just so much uncertainty surrounding these families. What was the most frustrating part of this ordeal?
Probably the timeline. You know, we can be frustrated with the extraction of the U.S. forces. We can be frustrated with the lack of diplomatic process, and then being, like you said, 7,000 miles away and not on the ground. I think anybody's frustration would be to not have enough agency in the situation to make something happen.
It's also important to remember that your student demographics are incredibly diverse. I mean, more than a dozen languages are spoken at FLI Baker Elementary. Yeah. And the fact that this family spoke English was really a saving grace.
Yeah, it was. Multilingual these people are in speaking Dari and Farsi and Pashto, and then also their level of English just eased the communication. I think that we would have gotten it done, but essentially I was communicating with a family and then communicating with this other entity or organization the entire time, along with other folks in a similar situation to mine, sort of representing the family, handling their case. And so it was this across the globe, I guess you could say, network of effort.
I can only imagine. Oh, actually, I think this is a great reminder. Weren't you giving the children lesson plans just to kind of keep them some busy work and to keep them distracted from such, as you said, a harrowing situation?
Yeah, the ironic part now is that where they are, they're in the humanitarian city in Abu Dhabi. Amazon delivers, so we sent them some and another company as well. So we sent them some, you know, coloring books and math workbooks and all of that stuff, which is just another, I guess, funny part of this before they come home.
I can only imagine how much relief they feel, you as well, obviously. But was there a palpable moment in your contact with them where you could really feel the weight of uncertainty lifted?
Yeah. We expressed some gratitudes for each other once they were safely out. And whatever that process looked like, but it was, spanning several days to get to that spot, of basically being on the whole time. And, the family's mother who had some existing health problems and I think was deeply affected by the stress and the trauma, said to me, "I'm finally able to relax a little bit," which meant a lot, because knowing how difficult it was for her to relax before then, that was something.
You know, we learned, and your district learned when school started, that this family wasn't the only one within Sac City Unified, and we know that there are families within San Juan Unified as well. I mean, the work is far from over.
It is. That's the other piece of it, that even so, this specific family, my family, were also leaving behind their extended family members who were hoping to get out. And there are still students, our constituents, that we are working hard to get out, who pertain to the, you know, to our county, Sacramento area. So one family is amazing because it's the one that I'm responsible for, but we are systemically responsible for getting all of these people back.
You know, generally speaking, with their privacy at front of mind, what can you share about the next steps in this process when they can actually, you know, put 2 feet in the United States?
Yeah, so we've worked hard to get donations financially to help the family kind of get back to set. A number of our partners have helped out in that regard. So doing our best to take care of their rent, but also restock their home, you know, help them with those things.
Right. Bills don't stop.
Absolutely not. Right. And when they come back, the expectation is that the kids are back in school. That's what the parents have been saying the entire time. Their primary concern has been making sure they stay up to date with their studies. So getting them back and kind of creating an academic plan that is an intervention one, because we need to, they've obviously missed a ton of school. Right. But at the same time, so, you know, we've had meetings about what intake process will look like for their mental health needs. We know that as I've spoken on before, the effects of trauma, run deep and can really disrupt one's day-to-day wellness. And so our plan is to serve the entire family in that regard. And we luckily have the resources to do that here at the school. I'm also exploring opportunities within our district in the area for some sustainable work for the parents who, again, have these pretty incredible linguistic ability on top of a wealth of post-secondary schooling, you know, degrees in political science and such. And so they'll be able to, I think, lend their expertise maybe to other folks who are trying to get out of Afghanistan or who are trying to rebuild their lives here.
Finally, school is a family, and you've talked about the toll, and we just heard the toll has had not only on this family, but on students and on staff and yourself included. Any plans for a celebration?
Yeah, when they get back, I mean, I think it calls for a party, you know, COVID mitigation rules intact. But I think we're going to try to welcome them as much as we can. It, you know, having finished it over the weekend, the emotional release was pretty intense. But we also do have 620 other kids at our school that deserve our attention. So we're going to welcome them back, and it's going to feel really good. And then they will reintegrate to the fold, all the while being supported.
Nate, thanks so much for joining us with just an amazing update.
Yeah, it is. Thanks so much, Vicky. And honestly, the way you've helped us elevate the story, I think, has made the difference in being able to find advocates in this situation. I think that was a game changer.
Well, thank you very much. That we really appreciate that. I mean, we're all human first, right?
That's right. Thanks, Vicky.
Nate McGill is the principal at Ethel I. Baker Elementary within Sac City Unified. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. The pandemic changed everything about the way we live our lives, from working, schooling, even how we buy our groceries. Some things have changed drastically. Childcare is one of the areas that really created a challenge for parents who still had to report to work in person as essential workers. The Pew Research Center found earlier this year that about half of employed parents with children younger than 12 found it difficult to handle childcare responsibilities. The center now reports that number has gone up 38% since the start of the pandemic. Finding childcare already just wasn't easy. It's expensive. Parents have to field providers, possible nannies, and babysitters to make sure that the person has a good bond with their child. Add that a shortage of childcare workers, and people are just left in search of childcare with few providers to choose from. A new NPR poll found that roughly a third of U.S. families are struggling to find childcare. In California, nearly 3 in 10 jobs in the childcare industry were lost during the pandemic. We're going to better understand all of those numbers and how this is impacting Sacramento. Heidi Kaiser is with the nonprofit Child Action Inc. and joins us now. Heidi, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
Heidi, how does your nonprofit serve the community?
One section of our work is involved around the subsidy program. So making sure that families can access the subsidies they need. If they're low income, they qualify for childcare, and then we help them get connected with potential childcare providers through that. We also help families of any income search for childcare. You can call our resource and referral department, and we'll link you up with potential childcare types. We don't pick your childcare provider, but we give you the details you need to provide a childcare facility that you that really meets your needs, whether that be an in-house family childcare home or a childcare center. And then also we help childcare providers. We help them get licensed. We help them with training, with the day-to-day operations, making sure that they have the tools that they need to provide quality childcare.
Yeah, I mean, there's like a supply and demand with this industry. Is that off balance right now? The need for childcare is outweighing the supply?
Well, we've certainly seen a reduction in the childcare supply, especially when the pandemic first hit. A lot of childcare providers found it difficult to continue operating. There was a reduction in the children that they were seeing just because many families were being forced to shelter in place. And then also the increased cost of supplies, having to clean even more so than they usually have to, and then increased cost of having to figure out how to make rent payments like the rest of the people have really struggled with, especially certain sectors within our community. We are seeing an increase now in some of the demand from families, but throughout the pandemic, our childcare providers were supporting our essential workers with their childcare need. But yeah, we've definitely seen a reduction in that childcare supply, and hopefully we're beginning to see some level of recovery, but to really meet the needs of our community, we definitely need to try to attract more people into the field.
So in our area, the biggest issue currently in this stage of the pandemic is actually needing more families to utilize childcare providers.
Yes, that's definitely a concern because as you're aware, there are still many people operating hybrid. There are still many people out of work. Thankfully, through the county, families can go through CalWORKs and get onto a childcare program through that means. But we imagine as we continue to see the county open up, we may struggle to meet the demand for childcare.
Affordability has been a real issue for childcare. I mean, before the pandemic, I mean, there are some, I just anecdotally have some friends who are like, I'm either working to pay for childcare or I stop working and take care of my children. How has affordability changed in the last 19 months of the pandemic?
Yeah, so as you can imagine, a lot of our families have been negatively impacted financially, as you've seen, the way that unemployment has kind of ebbed and flowed, it went significantly high. It's only now starting to go back towards a place of recovery. But when, for example, a parent says, my childcare costs more than my rent, and I'm not qualifying for subsidy yet, I'm still waiting, you can imagine that's a difficult situation to be in. And even if you can afford childcare, the situation at the moment seems to be that you may still have to be in that hybrid situation. So you may not be sending your child to childcare at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, this can just also just be such a difficult situation to navigate through for families. What solutions and resources are available to them?
So if a family is low income, they can apply for our subsidy program. Unfortunately, the concern there is we do have a significant wait list. Last time I checked, we have over 3,000 low-income families waiting for childcare. Based on current estimates, we're only going to be able to cover maybe a third of those through the state subsidy program. I guess there's a hope that you might qualify for that program under that. There's really a concern that despite significant state and federal funding, we're still not going to be able to meet the needs of low-income families in our community. We hope to see significant federal support and ongoing sustainable funding. I mean, that's the real issue here. We've seen a lot of stipends, a lot of short-term funding, which has been a decent lifeline for many of our providers. But it's not quite invigorating the system and ensuring that people can stay in business.
I mean, I guess what I'm hearing that your hands are tied. And this is, you know, an issue that not only affects providers and low-income families, but even middle-income families as well. Is this as it stands? I mean, is this sustainable?
Not unless unless we rebuild the system. I mean, to steal the current president's terminology of the Build Back Better. I mean, this needs significant reform. We're happy to see at the state level that they're looking at the reimbursement rate and how providers are paid. As you're aware, before the pandemic, providers were paid poverty wages. It's meaning that providers are leaving childcare, which is a big concern.
Yeah, that's so important. I mean, some of the wages were like $12 or $15 an hour, which is, you know, for caring for children is just so surprising. Heidi, thank you for joining us. And we just really appreciate all the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
And that is Heidi Kaiser with the nonprofit Child Action, Inc. Still ahead, blood service providers are reporting a critical shortage in supply not seen since the pandemic start. We'll learn what's causing the setback and what the biggest need is right now. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. As with many things in life, you never know how much you may need something until it comes a time when you really need it. Case in point, blood. I mean, it's time sensitive, to say the least. Right now, Vitalant, the nation's largest nonprofit blood services provider in the country, is raising the flag that supplies are not only low, but dangerously low around the country and here in Northern California. In fact, Vitalant says that type O blood, which is the most transfused blood type, is below a two-day supply. Now, that's the lowest since May of 2020. The blood is used in emergency situations across Vitalant's 900 hospital network, 50 of which are in the Northern California region. The rate of donations is now slipping below the rate of blood being used, and Vitalant is putting out a call out to everyone who can give blood to please donate. Joining us to talk about the critical need for blood and platelets is Dr. Chris Gressens, a medical director with Vitalant. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Thanks so much, Ms. Gonzalez-Bartel, or Vicky. Good morning.
Yes, Vicky Gonzalez. Well, Bartel is, you know, my husband's name, last name. Well, talk to us about, I mean, just how thin is the supply for blood and platelets? I mean, every year, seasonally, we get the call out from Vitalant to donate blood. What's different this time?
Yeah. What's really different is that demand recently has gone up unexpectedly fast, and supply from our wonderful donors has gone down largely for many of the same reasons that have contributed to supply chain challenges elsewhere in our society. The difference, of course, being that one can wait a few days before buying that new car, can't wait for that blood transfusion that's desperately needed. So that's why we're so grateful for this opportunity to speak with you.
What's contributing to this shortage, you think?
Many things, particularly that our donors' lives, and these are people who represent the depth and breadth of our society, are more challenged than they ever have been in recent years. And reaching them is more difficult. For instance, so much of our blood is collected at schools, which have to large extents been closed or limited in what they can do to help us. Organizations such as big companies and churches that are not convening as often with their large numbers of people. So it's harder to reach our donors, and our donors' lives, I think, in general, are more stressful. So we appreciate that, and we're going to great lengths to figure out solutions.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you hit home on such an important point with schools and churches and other religious organizations. I mean, there's a convenience there, right? If you're at school, yes, you can donate a pint.
Exactly. And without trivializing those great citizen, fellow human beings, they're a ready-made audience of donors, and we don't have access to that ready-made audience. And one last thing I'll share is that in particular, this is having challenges with regard to our ability to support, of course, all patients, particularly patients from communities of color and underserved communities, because in some cases, those patients can require very rare blood that best comes from donors of the same background. So it's been a challenge so far. We're meeting it, but it's been touch and go.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the rate of donations is slipping below the rate of blood being used. Can you just explain the ripple effects and how this is trickling down to actual patients that need life-saving blood and platelets?
Absolutely. First of all, I'll tell you one thing that we haven't done yet, which is to deny life-saving blood products to patients who need them. We haven't gotten to that point, and I will make sure we do everything, as my other colleagues will, to prevent that. That being said, though, we are asking our hospitals to carry lower inventories than they've ever been used to. And as a result, they sometimes have to make just-in-time replenishment orders that can cut it close. And I'm not aware of, across our 900 hospital system we serve, any actual untoward consequences involving patients, but that risk does exist, and we want to do everything we can to prevent somebody from suffering. The last thing I'll share is that we more and more are triaging requests like never before. One case in point is that one of our local hospitals, whereas we usually would have allowed a patient to have taken 2 units of platelets, I got involved 3 o'clock in the morning. I was called and determined that in this case, the patient actually could make do with 1 unit, and therefore we did cut it. It was an appropriate medical decision, but I hate to think of when I'm going to have to make a similar decision that potentially could impact patient care.
Yeah, I mean, it's a nerve-wracking situation, especially because blood and platelets also have a shelf life, so there's a balance there.
You're so right, Vicki. And for red cells, for instance, which are transfused to the tune of about 10 or 11 million per year across the United States, we have no more than about a 42-day shelf life. Practically speaking, it's closer to 38 days or thereabouts. For platelets, no more than a 7-day shelf life. Again, practically speaking, we're really talking 3 or 4 days of usable lifespan. So it is a challenge. And we don't want to cry, oh, poor us, because that's not a position we'll ever be in. We deal with the cards as they come to us. But at the same time, we do need help. And that's why we so appreciate your allowing us to speak with your audience.
Your hospital network includes about 50 or dozens of hospitals in Northern California. Where is the greatest need right now for those hospitals?
Right now, it's with Grupo Red Cells, as you shared earlier, as well, it's with platelet transfusions. In quick background, red cells primarily allow oxygen to be delivered to our tissues, so patients who don't have enough of them for various reasons, including bleeding, literally can starve from oxygen deficits in their bodies and die as a result. Platelets plug holes when patients are bleeding. They plug the tiny little holes in our blood vessels, and they are needed to prevent people literally from bleeding to death. So in some cases, patients can die. Thankfully, I'm not aware of any circumstances where we haven't been able to get the blood products they've needed, and I sure don't want to get to that point. I have been there in many other parts of the world. I've worked many, many months in parts of Africa, the former Soviet Union, and I've seen patients die in front of me from lack of blood. And it's terrible when it happens anywhere in the world. I can't imagine it happening in the United States. But then again, there are a lot of things in the last 20 months we never could have imagined happening in our country.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Vitalant says that about 3 people out of 100 who are eligible to donate do so. So that's 3%. For if that, hopefully that number increases, and if people are interested in donating, what do they need to know about eligibility?
Main thing about eligibility is that we encourage people to get onto our website. We also can subsequently provide you other contact information that perhaps you would be so kind as to post. In addition, if they have any questions ahead of time, because we don't want people to come in and spend time in a fruitless desire to donate if they can't, that's not fair to them or to us. We encourage them to reach us through contact channels that we have available. I'll leave it at that high-level reply, and if you and our viewers need more information, we'll gladly provide it.
And it's not only donors, right? Are you also in need of volunteers?
Yeah, we love that. In fact, while we make it a point not to impinge on our own coworkers' work opportunities, at the same time, there are certain functions that we just can't manage without volunteers. 2 cases in point. Number one, helping our donors following the donation process, making sure that they're well treated with refreshments as well as good follow-up care to make sure, for instance, in those rare cases, a donor might have a complication from donation that they're tended to. And then also driving. We have driving possibilities for delivering blood products, and a number of our volunteers have just been critically important to that.
Well, Chris, before we let you go, are there any blood drives we should be aware of? Or if someone wants to host a blood drive, a business, how do they go about doing that?
I encourage, with regard to the latter question, our audience to go to the Vitalant.org website, and you can, through the search function, look into hosting a blood drive, type in those words. I must admit, I'm actually going to spend more time in future checking out perfect answers to that question. But also, if they have questions, they can call in. We do have personed lines that they can call into also on vitalant.org.
Dr. Gressens, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ms. Gonzalez, Vicky, and wish you and our audience wonderful end of season holidays. And please, if you can, donate blood.
And that is Dr. Chris Gressens, a medical director from Vitalant. And if listeners, if y'all want to donate, we actually have a link on our website at capradio.org/insight to connect you with Vitalant. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at the Insight page at capradio.org. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Pauline Bartoloni, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Radio's Chief Content Officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.